she disappeared and everything in my life disappeared after that.
The state Supreme Court hears arguments on a case involving survivor benefits for a woman whose partner was killed at work. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the billionaire husband of Anchorage Daily News publisher Alice Rogoff gives big in Washington.
This was just a down payment on my obligation to repay the country for what it has done for me and for my family.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Alaska Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case that challenges whether same-sex couples should receive survivor benefits. Deborah Harris's long-term partner, Carrie Fadley, was shot and killed when working at the Millennium Hotel in 2011. According to Alaska law, spouses receive survivor benefits if their husband or wife is killed from a work-related injury. Same-sex couples do not, because they can't legally marry in Alaska. Harris says after her partner was killed, she couldn't afford to stay in her home.
A lot of couples, you know, you have workman's comp, you have that safety net, you have access to those benefits that can kind of help you get along. And in my case, it wasn't there, and everything, she disappeared and everything in my life disappeared after that.
Donald Thomas argued on behalf of Millennium Hotel, which denied Harris's request for death benefits.
If the marriage amendment is precluding same-sex couples from marriage, it is inherently, implicitly denying them, any person who's not validly married, the rights and benefits of marriage.
Lambda legal staff attorney Peter Wren represented Harris. He says same-sex couples are denied the safety nets that heterosexual couples can access.
State law absolutely discriminates against loving, committed same-sex couples in this context, and it has no adequate reason for doing so.
Wren says the case does not directly challenge the same-sex marriage ban, but the court could choose to take up the matter. This is the third case before the state Supreme Court that has challenged unequal benefits for same-sex couples. In both 2005 and 2014, the court ruled that same-sex couples should not be discriminated against, but the court stopped short of striking down the marriage ban. Yesterday, five couples filed a case in federal district court directly challenging that ban. If you've heard anything about Alice Rogoff, the woman who recently bought the Anchorage Daily News, you'll likely know that she's married to a billionaire. David Rubenstein founded the Carlyle Group, a Washington, D.C.-based private equity firm, and he's number 209 on the Forbes list of wealthiest Americans. APRN's Liz Ruskin wanted to learn more about him, and she started at the Washington Monument.
The Washington Monument reopened this week for the first time since it was damaged in a 2011 earthquake. A ribbon-cutting ceremony Monday featured military bands, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, Washington's mayor, and TV weatherman Al Roker. But the man of the hour was David Rubenstein, who single-handedly paid half of the $15 million repair bill.
$7.5 million, which is incredible. Thank you, David.
It's an historic, generous, heroic act.
I'm grateful to David Rubenstein.
Once again, another round of applause for David Rubenstein, please.
Rubenstein, with white hair and serious glasses, looks a bit like the actor Steve Martin if he were playing someone wonky. He says he may be the only person to have climbed up the Washington Monument in a suit and tie. His public speeches are often laced with witty, self-effacing asides, but when it was his turn at the microphone Monday, Rubenstein spoke only briefly.
I have had good fortune, and I really wanted to give back to the country, and this was just a down payment on my obligation to repay the country for what it has done for me and for my family.
He's done a lot of this patriotic philanthropy lately, and it's helping him achieve a reputation makeover. After 9/11, Rubenstein became known as the mastermind of Carlyle Group. Conspiracy theories swirled around his private equity firm, mostly because it invested money from wealthy Saudis, and also because it hired ex-prime ministers and Pentagon big shots who opened doors, making the firm rich. A more recent rumor, all over certain YouTube channels, has it that Carlyle Group is behind the disappearance of that Malaysian jet.
Are we to believe the NSA's private surveillance army, run by the Carlyle Group, has no information on Flight 370?
It's been discredited, but to some, lack of evidence only proves it further.
Who's the conspiracy theorist now?
But Carlyle Group has changed its style. Rubenstein says he failed to forecast how his firm would be perceived in a post-9/11 world. The ex-presidents and cabinet secretaries retired and weren't replaced. Rubenstein told Forbes magazine he's depoliticized the firm. Now, Rubenstein is making headlines with big patriotic giving, such as $10 million to restore George Washington's estate at Mount Vernon, and the same for Thomas Jefferson's place at Monticello, plus $75 million for the Kennedy Center. He's also purchased copies of the founding documents of the United States. He recently said it all started for him when he heard the Magna Carta, the 13th century ancestor of the Bill of Rights, was on the auction block at Sotheby's.
The things that enable me to rise up from modest circumstances are kind of the freedoms that are embodied in these documents, so I really want to do something about it. I decided I was going to go buy the Magna Carta.
Yes, he says he knows that sounds presumptuous. But he did buy it for $21 million, and it's on display now in the David M. Rubenstein Gallery at the National Archives. Pretty good for the son of a postal worker and a homemaker who grew up in Baltimore. He told the New York Times when he's considering how to give his money away, he aims for things to make his mom proud. Rubenstein went to law school on a scholarship and married Alice Rogoff in 1983. He told Washington Society interviewer Carol Joint at a luncheon a few years ago he never fell in love with Alaska the way his wife did.
I'm not big on the outdoors. I got out of the car to come in here. I was outside for about 10 seconds.
As chance would have it, though, he kind of owes his fortune to Alaska. In the 1980s, when Rubenstein and his partners were scratching for their first few million, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens authored a complex law allowing Alaska Native corporations to sell their operating losses. Rubenstein brokered those deals, helping profitable companies buy those losses to owe less in taxes. He says his big innovation was an accounting method that found far more losses than the $50 million originally projected. He once said his firm sold some $8 billion worth. Everyone was a winner, except maybe the U.S. Treasury. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Shishaldin volcano is rumbling to life in the Aleutian Islands. The Alaska Volcano Observatory detected long tremors and an increase in surface temperatures at Shishaldin earlier today. Those could be signs of an eruption, says Robert McGimsey. He's a geologist at the AVO.
Typical eruptions of Shishaldin have involved what we call Strombolian eruptions, which are gas-charged emissions.
Shishaldin, which is located on Unimak Island, is unique among volcanoes in Alaska. It doesn't have a lava plug or a dome, just a deep, open vent. For now, there's no lava coming out of Shishaldin. Satellite images show steam and some light traces of ash. But McGimsey says when Shishaldin does erupt,
it's gas bubbles coming up through the throat or the vent of the volcano, and when they pop, it kind of throws magma up into the air. I mean, that's kind of what defines lava fountaining.
That lava glides down the flanks of the volcano, leaving a smooth layer. That's why Shishaldin is the most symmetrical conical volcano in the world. The AVO started logging small explosions and ash clouds at Shishaldin this winter. They elevated the volcano's official alert level in March. Today's activity is the most active that the volcano has been since 2009. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Yukon River biologists prepare for another low king run.
And I think most people on the river really, really understand this, that it's a problem. We're doing a lot to conserve fish, and we're still not making goals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Bethel City Council voted unanimously to fire City Manager Lee Foley during a special meeting on Monday. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The termination comes after the three-month-long investigation conducted by a third-party attorney into nepotism, contracts, and personnel issues, among other concerns. Councilmember Mark Springer noted that Foley had done a lot of good for the city.
However, it is the council's prerogative at any time to terminate a city manager, and in light of matters that have come to our attention and that have been given very serious consideration by the council, that's why I'm making this motion. And as I said in a previous meeting, this is not something that we're taking lightly.
Mayor Joe Klaka said there were at least three contracts that were not sent out for competitive bidding, including the demolition of the old police station. The mayor would not name the other two, but the investigation included examination of city contracts with former finance director Bobby Sutton.
We have not been following Bethel Municipal Code. As our administrator of the city, he is the person who is most responsible for that to occur. Mm-hmm. And it's just not been followed multiple times.
The council has confirmed violations within the city related to procurement, nepotism, credit card usage, personnel policies, leave, and travel and training policies. Foley's son, Bo, works for the city's IT department, which violates current city code. In an interview with the Anchorage Daily News, Foley admitted to using a city credit card for personal business and allowing department heads to do the same before paying back the money. The termination was effective immediately. Foley has been city manager since July of 2008. Port Director Pete Williams has been the acting city manager since Foley was placed on administrative leave in April. The council is hoping to hire a human resources director soon in efforts to ensure personnel policies are followed. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The run size for Yukon River Chinook or king salmon is likely to be lower than last year's. Fishermen saw the lowest run of kings on record in 2013. Sport fishing throughout the entire Yukon River drainage area, including the Tanana River, is closed this summer. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, biologists don't expect enough fish for a subsistence or commercial harvest this year either.
Anywhere between 64 and 121,000 Chinook salmon could swim up the Yukon River this summer. Stephanie Schmidt is Fish and Game's Yukon River research biologist. She expects the run size to be close to the lower end of that range.
Because the last several years, we've seen run sizes that have come in lower or at that low end of our preseason projections.
If she's right, this summer's run could be the lowest on record in the Yukon River. Schmidt says there could be several reasons for the decline in king salmon.
And I always like to use the analogy of a rivet in an airplane. And if you take one rivet out, the airplane will still fly. And if you take two out, it'll still fly. But once you start taking three, four, five rivets out, eventually your airplane is going to crash.
Fish and Game is trying to manage the king salmon population so that up to 55,000 fish make it to Canada. That's close to 86% of the lower end of the projected total run size. Eric Newland is Fish and Game's Yukon Area Summer Season Manager. He says there hasn't been a lot of argument against closing sport fishing, as well as subsistence and commercial harvest this summer.
And I think most people on the river really, really understand this, that it's a problem. We're having difficulties making these goals. We're doing a lot to conserve fish, and we're still not making goals.
Biologists are looking for ways to allow for harvest of other species in place of king salmon.
Initially, we'll be trying to provide harvest for sheafish in the lower river, whitefish in other districts, as well as summer chum when those fish become available a little later in the season. And at that time, we'd be using gear types that allow for the release of king salmon. if they're incidentally caught at that time.
Newland says last year's commercial harvest of chum salmon, also known as dogs, was one of the largest on record. The subsistence harvest last summer was also up for chums. Fish and Game expects a strong fall chum this year as well. In the meantime, several research initiatives to investigate the king salmon decline are underway. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska is celebrating a century of aviation. As part of an occasional series, we've invited seasoned aviators to tell us about their adventures at the controls. Retired Anchorage pilot Warren Polsky came to Alaska with his family when he was 9 and got his pilot's license at age 16. He flew with the Civil Air Patrol for the next 50 years on search and rescue missions. One memorable flight was right after the 1964 earthquake. Polsky took the first plane into Whittier, flying in two workers from the Department of Public Safety. He says the ground was covered in debris and he needed to attempt to land on an airstrip maintained by the railroad.
I went down there and I looked at this thing from fairly high. The weather was nasty. It was snowing and blowing about 40 miles an hour, and it just wasn't really a good day. And so finally I decided, well, I'll give it a shot. And so I let down, and about the time I got real low, I realized their runway wasn't as wide as my wheels were. And the runway was the width of a railroad locomotive, which, had, you know, they'd use a snowblower on the locomotive to plow it out down through the warehouses. And I was pretty slow, and it was getting banged around pretty good, and I was committed. And the problem was I had to approach it downwind. And so I knew I couldn't land in there. So I started to go around. Well, like I said, I was going downwind, and the next thing I saw was a light pole coming at me. And I managed to skid around it. And the next thing I saw was a 172 at the end of this, end of the warehouses, they're all banged up. And I went staggering off over the end of the dock, and we almost went into the water.
What's a 172?
Yeah, it was an airplane. Its wings were off, and the fuselage was all bent up and stuff. Anyway, and so I got the airplane back under control finally and started climbing out and heading back to Anchorage. And I says to these two guys, I said, what were we going down there for anyway? Well, they said, we had a couple bodies to recover. I says, we almost had three more, And I got back here and I called the railroad and I told the railroad, you can build railroads, but don't tell us you build airports.
Anchorage resident Warren Polsky is a retired pilot.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This year, residents along the Kuskokwim River experienced a rare breakup when the river seemingly broke up in reverse. While elders say this year was a unique event, they also believe it could be a sign of things to come. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
The Kuskokwim River serves as the main transportation route for the Yupik living along it. People use it to reach other villages and gather their food, so predicting its behavior is an essential part of survival. Atmoshlok elder Henry Tikyun says this breakup was unlike anything he's ever seen.
They said the weather would change with the people. I never thought I'd ever reach this in my lifetime.
Originally from Bethel, Tikyun recounts his childhood memories when seasons were more predictable.
In my first memories in Bethel, upriver areas like McGrath and Aniak would always break up first. After that, downriver would break up, even though it's closer to the ocean.
Tikyun says the ice would be much thicker in those days. Breakup would be signaled by loud rumbling from the river caused by ice grinding and breaking against each other. He says the climate is changing because of the way people treat the land.
All of us, just the same, are polluting our land with no respect.
Tikyun points to trashed field drums along riverbanks as just one of numerous examples. At the mouth of the Kuskokwim, Tuntutuliak elder and pilot James Charles says the early downriver breakup is attributed to the lack of snow and thin ice.
The lower area had no snow and the ice was thin, so it broke up first. It usually breaks up last when there's snow.
Charles says he's noticed reports of melting glaciers and permafrost and believes this is attributed to global warming.
People say our land is thawing and getting warmer, and I believe what they call global warming is happening.
On the south side of the Kuskokwim Bay, Elder John Alexi says breakup near Eek was similar to just one other that occurred about a decade ago. He says warming temperatures were predicted by his ancestral elders.
I used to hear from people who came before me that the weather would change and the winters would be different. It wouldn't be as cold as it used to be.
Alexi also heard some of the elders mention that while this area gets warmer, the other areas in the lower 48 would get colder with harsher winters. While breakup was unusual this year, the elders say similar breakups may not be uncommon in the future. This is Charles Enoch.
Two of the greatest living scholars on Sitka's Russian and Tlingit past were in Sitka last week to train National Park Rangers on the historic battles that took place there. Park rangers give programs, but sometimes they'll interact with visitors for only a few minutes. So the challenge is, how do you teach visitors about the culture in a memorable way? KCAW's Emily Foreman reports.
I'm on a bus tour. All the passengers are trained historical interpreters, and the tour guides are the leading scholars on the topic. They literally wrote the book.
One of the earliest recordings of the history is from Sally Hopkins, and her daughter asked Nora if she would transcribe and translate this.
Nora and Dick Downhower are the authors of Russians in Tlingit America, the definitive work on the battles of 1802 and 1804. The bus stops in Old Sitka.
Is this good?
Yes, thank you.
It's just a patch of grass near the ferry terminal. But in 1802, it was where Tlingit warriors attacked the Russian fort.
This is Dick, and Nora is right there in the blue sweater.
Hi.
I like workers. Your book.
Thank you.
I make all my staff read it.
I think it's a good one, and I'm glad it's in there because my memory isn't what it used to be, so at least it's all in there now.
The Downhowers are in town to advise Sitka Park Rangers how to reinterpret the history for transient cruise ship passengers that know nothing about it. Nora is Tlingit and a native speaker of the language.
The way we got into this is I was teaching Tlingit in Juneau High School, and I got this letter from a professor.
Dick was the professor. He admired her work.
As they say, the rest is history. We've just been partners in scholarship for over 40 years, and we had our 40th anniversary in November.
Somewhere along the line, they got married.
Still doing business at the same old stand, but it was a little slower than we used to be.
While the relationship was always solid, the making of Russians in Tlingit America was an on-again, off-again kind of affair.
But the first issue that came up to us in doing this book was, who owns history?
Nora was asked to translate Tlingit oral histories recounting the battles, but then native elders didn't want to rehash the past, which put the book on hold. When elders died, the new generation wanted to know the history. Then the Soviet Union crumbled, freeing up access to Russian archives. It took decades of cultural and political change before they could complete the book.
So these are difficult issues, and I think it's important to kind of be upfront that this is living history. This is not something that just happened 200 years ago, but people are very aware of that here.
Sitkins might be very aware of the history, but tourists from Idaho? The challenge is getting visitors to care. I asked second season tour guide Janet Drake about her approach.
Yeah, so much research and mm-hmm. so many different sources, a combination of written and oral mm-hmm. history, and then you have to synthesize this for a group of tourists that might
know
have
nothing about this place. And
how do you do that?
I know, it's that's the challenge, finding those pieces that hit home for people.
What's like the most common question you get?
Where's the bathroom? Just kidding. But actually, that's kind of serious.
Chief of Interpretation Becky Latanich is always thinking about how to make the history relatable.
I think visitors have a hard time relating to this story. They come here and they don't know anything about it, and they think mm-hmm. Sitka and they think totem poles. But then the battle's a little difficult for people because it's not well known, it's not Gettysburg. So do you have any suggestions for our staff about what themes you've encountered that people might be able to relate to?
My take on this is it's sort of like the Alamo or Midway, where the real estate is not all that significant. But whoever controlled Sitka controlled the whole Northwest Coast fur trade. And, you know, if you've got a flair for the dramatic, you can reinterpret for the tourists. Here you imagine Katlyan coming down and the Russians, and they're on the beach and they're landing. And then all of a sudden the Russians are behind them, and here's Katlyan with his hammer, because it's easier to bash heads in than it is to stick a dagger in and pull a dagger out. And
while engaging tourists is one thing, retelling the story in a way that's respectful of the families that have a personal connection to the history is another. Some parts of this history are so sensitive that the Downhowers were actually asked to omit some of the details, and they did because that's the respectful thing to do.
And that's, of course, the challenge of ethnohistory, is that you are dealing with families and with the family memories, family traditions.
The idea that family history is complicated, most people, even out-of-town visitors, can relate to that. In Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ben Matheson and Charles Enoch in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Emily Foreman in Sitka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. SalmonLove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.